Well.
With a bit more gusto.
Oh, sorry. Well.
Oh.
Is that what we're looking for? I don't know.
Maybe one more time, just okay. in between.
you went from a 1 to a 10.
Yeah.
Need you to be about a 6.
Yeah.
Well.
Is a hole in the ground?
I'm almost angry. Like, that's my reaction. It's one of, you've built this up. Today, we shall talk about something very dear to my heart.
Ooh, I like that opening.
But
first,
before we do, this week, I thought I would give blood.
Good.
I jumped on the website because I saw an ad, good advertising.
Mm-hmm.
I've never given blood.
Mm-hmm.
Saw the ad and I was like, yes, that's for me.
Mm-hmm. Was there something that prompted you this time? Because I assume it's not the first time you've seen the ad.
No, I have previously tried, but something happened or there wasn't availability mm-hmm. close to me.
Yep.
There's not a lot of places near where I live.
Mm-hmm.
The nearest one's about 15 Ks away.
Yep.
And when I do the shift work stuff that I was doing, you would look at it and it just became too difficult.
Yeah.
So this time I was like, well, no, it has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I need to do it. The website's great.
Yep.
Shows you all the centers by distance. You can sort them by distance. You choose what sort of donation you want to make, like blood or plasma, and I don't know what the difference is. Or ask a doctor.
All of the above.
Plasma. And so I booked an appointment.
Yep.
There's one, like a pop-up one.
Okay.
Close to my house.
Okay.
3 Ks away. For the next day at 4:45.
Oh, wow.
Next day rolls around. Mm-hmm. Check the calendar. What's the address for this place?
Yep.
Well, it's not in the calendar. That's weird.
No.
Just scroll through.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be, oh, it's the 12th of April. Booked my blood donation for the 12th of April. Just for those playing at home, we're recording this on the 9th of March.
So the upshot is the Red Cross is in dire need of blood and you have not assisted
in
the slightest.
Not even close to helping.
No. I've seen that reservation pop through and gone, thanks, mate.
Yeah, thanks very much, dickhead.
Thanks for fitting us into your calendar. Yep, good. But nevertheless, your intent was there.
It is, and I will rebook it
mm-hmm.
As I would encourage anyone who is listening to do.
Please do.
Anyway.
Mm.
That's my story.
Good.
How was your week?
Nothing much on this week, really. It's been a quiet one. So.
Wrap it up then, shall we? Thanks for listening. see you in 2 weeks.
Look, I've started radiotherapy.
Big week.
Big week, started radiotherapy. New treatment. It's for me, it's become kind of like one of those Pokemon, got to catch them all. How many cancer treatments are there and can I have them all? And I'm ticking them off.
Yep.
Radiotherapy is the next one, which is, you know, exciting. And I think as the podcast episodes go on into our future, as we become the nation's most impressive and probably intolerable health podcast.
what do you mean become? I feel like
we've been
intolerable for a long time.
you know, we'll talk more about radiotherapy, I think, probably in our future.
Sure.
But today, I think what I want to acknowledge is my cancer anniversary.
Cancerversary.
Many people find it a bit bizarre to celebrate your cancer anniversary, which is an anniversary of the day that I was diagnosed.
Mm.
I find it quite important because I guess as a stage 4 patient, if you're celebrating anniversaries, you're ticking off milestones that perhaps someone might have thought you might not have made. And by someone, I mean science. We're celebrating this week my 5-year since diagnosis anniversary.
But let me ask you, I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, two weeks ago, whenever it was that we last did this, we talked about how you were struggling a bit in the sort of void between treatments.
Yep.
You've had three.
Three.
I've only driven you to two, so they're the ones that matter to me. I don't, this isn't about you. You've had three rounds.
I've had
doses.
Yeah. Fractions.
Fractions.
Of radiotherapy.
How are you feeling?
Good. Much better. Better mentally. to be doing something rather than doing nothing. Of course, you know, as a cancer patient, then you find like a different reason to stress. I've got plenty of those, but I, you know, in summary, feel better to be doing something rather than nothing.
Glad to hear it. Jinx, buy me a Coke.
Sorry, you go first.
Well, no, this would be the time normally in our incredibly professionally structured, well thought out podcast where we would introduce a patient. So go like to do that now.
Please.
It's you.
Oh, it's me.
You're patient number four.
You got me.
Yeah.
Here I am.
Celebrating 5 years of cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the way to word that, but I mean, that's what I'm going with.
I'm going with it too.
So, dearest Nicole, I've never asked this question.
Ooh, here we go.
Won't you tell us how you became a patient?
Yes, I will. And can I just say, you guys are a bunch of legends. And thanks so much for having me on
still,
the podcast.
I'm still waiting for you to magically produce cookies. I'm just expecting that, that you've got them in your pocket or something. You've had them with you all day.
Look, the episode isn't over yet. All right. So just you never know. Thank you for having me, though. Look, I became a patient. Well, I actually describe the start of my patient journey as sort of coinciding with when I became pregnant with Josh. So he was born in 2016 and I had just meandered through the health system, just, you know, heading to a GP when we needed to, and maybe we needed a blood test when we needed one, and we just kind of did what we did. I'd had a couple of knee surgeries and, you know, I think a scope once when I was much younger. Never really needed anything health-wise. And when I got pregnant, you suddenly realize that there is a system, really. Well, at least I did, because there's a much more regular tempo of appointments and and you're in the system. So I had Josh in 2016, July, and he was obviously perfection and has remained that way ever since. And then I started to feel a little bit tired. I'm a little bit of a workaholic. I don't know if you're picking up that about me in general, as someone who's running a business, a podcast, during stage four cancer treatment. But I was a workaholic and I was very keen to get back into work. And that for me at the time involved a lot of interstate travel, but I was doing that with Josh. He came everywhere with me and I was feeling tired, and I went to see a GP who wasn't my regular GP because he was on leave, and just sort of said to this GP, look, I feel tired and I feel like I'm losing weight postpartum. So after my pregnancy, I was losing weight faster than I expected to be losing weight. My jeans were kind of really loose and everyone said, wow, you look amazing, but I felt like crap. And I got really a bit of a judgmental response from this GP, who was a similar age to me.
So how old were you at the time?
32.
Okay.
And she sort of said, look, I mean, I think you're just a brand new mum and you're not sleeping well and you probably need to also adjust your expectations as to what life is going to look like now for you. So just, you know, try to relax and you'll be fine. Off you hop. And I got into the car and cried for a while because I was really sure that if I'd gone to see a GP that I was going to get some answers, and it had taken me a bit to get up the courage to go to a GP because I felt like I was failing a little bit as a new mum by even going to see a GP because I should have had this under control, because everyone's, you know, half the population is doing this, having a baby thing. So surely I should just be able to figure it out. So I went a few more weeks, months actually, before I sat down with my mum and we both agreed that no, I needed to go back and see my actual GP and figure out what was going on. So he said, look, Nicole, no one knows your body better than you. And if you feel like there's a problem, well, then there's a problem. Let's find it. You know, there's reason enough to go hunting. So we started with blood tests, which didn't show anything. I had, you know, up until that point, I'd kind of been losing weight and felt a little bit tired. I'd started to have some abdominal like cramping in the kind of the gap and felt a little bit of kind of pressure in my belly and what have you. So he sort of said, well, let's do some fecal tests. Let's do some, he sort of said, let's start with an ultrasound because we were looking for gallstones, because I guess when you've got to start with a body and you're starting in an abdominal area, then you kind of just got to pick a target, and that seemed to be like a one to start with. So we had an ultrasound. The ultrasound, I remember, you know, the wand kind of moving across my body, getting to my liver, and the technician, I feel like Adam, shall we call them a technician? Let's call them a technician. Hi, Adam. Shout out to Adam.
We miss you, Adam.
We got to the liver and she said, oh, look, yeah, you know, not much at the time, but went to see a gastroenterologist afterwards who said, look, it looks like there's some abnormalities in your liver. We think it's probably a condition called focal nodular hyperplasia, which is...
Just going to have to stop you on
yeah,
that
I'm going to I'm gonna clarify that one. I'm going to clarify that it's playing at home. They're basically like sort of non-malignant, non-cancery, non-scary tumours that they said quite often occurred in females who had been on birth control pills for an extended period of time.
Right.
So these things can just pop up in your liver, no big deal. Just to make sure, let's do an MRI, which is the magnetic tube, which is the really loud one, the really loud and
the one that I get. I get real claustrophobic.
People get claustrophobic. Yeah.
But they put those glasses on with a little mirror, so you can.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 Yeah.
Helps me a lot
when they do a brain one. Yeah.
No, I had, I have back or chest.
Or back or chest. Yeah. They're not actually. I shouldn't say that loud and scary. People are going, oh my god, I've got an MRI tomorrow. What are you doing to me? But they're not. They're actually fine. I have one pretty much every 3 months at the moment. They're fine. But at the time, you know, I felt a little bit stressed. Mm. And they called me back in after the MRI. I had had to fast and I couldn't really eat anyway and I was uncomfortable. And they called me sort of right as the sun was setting and it was just the most...
Who's they? Who called?
The gastroenterologist called me back in and said, come in, don't bring Josh, bring your husband. So I had to put Josh into the car and had to drive, you know, like you think back to these moments, like why did I drive a car in that state? That was crazy, but I kind of had no choice at the time. Met Tim's mum, at the clinic. We gave her Josh and we went upstairs and they said, yeah, look, we think that it's, cancer that's spread to your liver. And we think it's probably bowel cancer. It could be breast cancer, but we think it's probably bowel cancer. And the way that we'll get definite on that is doing a colonoscopy. So we did that, like scheduled for kind of 2 days later. So I did the bowel prep straight away, went in, did that.
Can I just ask at that point, cancer that's spread to the liver?
Yeah.
Seems to me that definitionally that's probably bad.
Bad, yeah.
Did you have any indication at that time
how bad?
How bad, just those words on their own?
Me, no. People around me, yes. So I think Tim had more of a sense of this is not good news. And Tim's family certainly did. But like, I mean, you know, we grew up together, as it turns out. You and I, we didn't have much exposure.
Wait, you and me?
That was me. Yeah. Didn't have any exposure to cancer, right? I didn't really get it. But I, you know, it's funny because I just have this overwhelming kind of memory of going, it's all right. It was traumatic and horrible and got more and more so in the next few days. But I just remember having this awe that people beat cancer all the time. So that's fine. Like, I'm up for this. I'm up for treatment. We're going to beat cancer. That's fine.
Sure.
You know, bring it on.
That was like at that point you had that.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. I had a real like, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Like I remember driving to that gastroenterologist by myself with my really brand new baby in the back of the car going, and I spoke to him the whole way there. It was like a 20-minute drive. It's going to be fine, Joshua. It's going to be fine. Mama's going to go and we're going to go have this conversation and I'm going to bring you with me and it's going to be fine. And we're just going to see what happens and it's all going to be okay. And don't worry. And I've got this and you don't have to worry and it's going to be okay. And that was just the kind of my operating mentality for the whole thing.
Okay. So you're in the gastroenterologist's office.
Yep.
They tell you they think it's cancer.
Yeah. 2 days later I go into hospital for a scope. And at that point they'd set me up with an oncologist and said, when you get to the other side of this scope, you're going to go speak to a cancer doctor. Here's their card. Here's an appointment. And I remember thinking, wow, they've, you know, everyone's fit me in so quickly. This is so amazing.
Yeah.
You know, such high standards of care.
Is a scope a colonoscopy?
Colonoscopy. Yes. Yeah, sorry. Yep. Yep.
Camera up the bum.
Camera up the bum. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so I did that, went to see an oncologist. I went with myself, Tim, and both our mums. So
I have to ask, when you say you went with yourself.
Yeah. Why do you have to pick these things up? I'm in the middle of a really emotional, reliving my cancer diagnosis.
In the third person, apparently.
In the third person. I went with myself.
Please,
I went with myself and Tim and our parents, which is something, quite frankly, that you couldn't even picture ever doing in COVID times. Like,
this is never
going to happen ever again.
Sure.
But at the time, that's what we did. 5 years ago, actually. Yeah. Just over five years ago.
But Mum and Dad were in Perth, right? So they had to come over.
They had to come over from Perth, yeah. And so we walked in there and I think we were ready for bad news, but it was delivered to us in a most unsatisfactory manner, really, in a really haphazard way, as if this person had never actually delivered metastatic cancer news before. And, you know, upon reflection, I've thought about it many times and I wonder whether it kind of had to do with the fact that this oncologist had had a sort of a team meeting and had decided on a pathway of treatment for me before ever having met me. And now here I was kind of in front of them with a very different real life experience of how this was going to impact me as a person, and being only 32 years old with a brand new baby with a stage 4 metastatic bowel cancer, and that was being presented to me as basically untreatable, as something that I was going to die from and would likely die from within sort of 18 months to 2 years.
So what do you mean? What's this team meeting?
So in medicine, we it's got nothing to do with me, as it turns out. They have a multidisciplinary team meeting, which is basically a meeting of the minds of all of the people who would potentially have something to say on the treatment journey. So that's going to be, of course, the oncologist. But because my cancer had spread to my liver, well, then we would get a hepatic surgeon in the room to say, well, is liver surgery, you know, an option? There was also an indication of a spread to my lungs. So we would have a thoracic surgeon in there to say, well, could lung surgery be an option? And everyone would kind of weigh in and put their professional expertise on the table to sort of make an assessment and a judgment on the best pathway to treatment, and all sort of be multidisciplinary and collaborative in their approach on the outcome.
So this is, well,
and not the outcome. Well, maybe the outcome too.
So this is a room full of doctors.
Yes.
Deciding what they think is the next best course of action for you based on, I'm assuming, scans.
Having never met me.
And you did just finish saying that it was nothing to do with you, but I feel like it's everything to do with you also.
Well, yes, that's been part of my advocacy journey since. But at the time, it had nothing to do with me and the decision had been made. And so when I was sitting in front of my brand new oncologist, this person sort of said to me, look, I've had a meeting of my peers. You know, these are the best of the best, the greatest and best minds in oncology and in cancer care in Melbourne, and I believe them, a very prestigious hospital. We've all come together and we've all agreed that really, like, this is a really, really, really sad story, but there's just nothing we can do. This is really, really tragic and this happens in cancer and it's really, really sad. But do you have a liver surgeon yourself that you wanted to see?
Oh, yeah, I just pull out the Rolodex.
The Rolodex of liver surgeons. He's no. So they suggested I saw their liver surgeon, who, you know, of course, was a part of that multidisciplinary team.
The self-proclaimed best in the world death committee. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sure.
So when I went to see this particular surgeon and sort of said, look, what do you think? Well, no, there's not much you can do. And my mum was really insistent. She's a fighter. My mum, I don't know about your mum. She's the same. She can be a bit argumentative and a bit insistent. Mum.
I think passionate is probably better.
Very passionate, yeah. I'm kind of playing around. She would call herself argumentative.
She would say, no, you're wrong, actually.
But she was very passionate in that moment and said, look, buddy, like, this is my daughter's life you're talking about. Like, who would you have weigh in on this opinion? Who, you know, if this was your family member, where's the surgeon you would be sending your loved one to? And he kind of sat back in his chair and kind of chuckled a bit and said, well, I'd be sending my family member to the surgeon in the UK in London, but that's not an option for you now, is it?
He sounds swell.
Yeah, he was a member of the death committee, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like aspirationally, any doctors in training that might be listening.
Yeah, that's not the approach. That's not the gold standard of care. So we kind of walked away from all of these meetings going, right, okay, well, this just doesn't feel right. Tim's family had a lot more experience in cancer, tragically, than our family had. And Tim's mum sort of said, look, you know, I don't want to interrupt here, guys, but, you know, I do actually know a liver surgeon.
She pulled out the Rolodex.
She did. She pulled it out and sort of offered it up, you know. And I just remember being like really so – at that moment, really disenchanted is an understatement, but with the whole thing, like, fine, well, what good is it going to do going to see someone else who's going to tell me that my life is about to end? But yeah, sure, okay, let's go see someone else. So we did.
Let me – this feels like the opportune moment to talk about second opinions.
Ooh.
Do you have the same mindset now?
The same mindset?
What good is it going to do?
Well, now – 5 years later.
Yeah, I just want you to tell the world second opinions are important. Would you just say
that? World, if you're listening, second opinions are essential, actually, in healthcare and should actually be considered the backbone of, in my opinion, the whole diagnostic process, right? Yeah. And I think if we were doing anything else in life as human beings, we see it as quite fundamental. You know, I'm going to do a renovation, I'll get an opinion, and then I'll get a second one. Mm. I'm going to do this plumbing job, I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to buy this car that I've decided on. I'm still going to shop it around with three different dealers across the city to get the best price. But when it comes to healthcare, for whatever reason, we just take the first opinion that's dealt out. Not the smartest play. So I went to see the second opinion liver surgeon who said, yeah, Nicole, look, what you've got in front of you is not a very pretty situation and I'm not going to sugarcoat that in any way, shape or form. But there are different approaches that we can take and there are different ways of thinking about a single problem. And at the moment, you know, is your liver operable? No, it's not. And I think we should sort of clarify that that bowel cancer becomes a problem, right? Not necessarily because of the cancer in the bowel, but because of the way it spreads throughout the body, the systems that it attacks and the way that it shuts those systems down, right? And so if you've got a liver full of cancer, eventually that liver is going to stop functioning. It's not going to be able to do the things that it needs to do to keep you alive, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why we like to cut it out. So if we can cut cancer out, we like to do that. It removes it as a problem. Mm. And so he sort of said, look, can we do that now? No. But we need to throw chemotherapy at this problem because maybe one day we can. And I've seen cases where things that were, you know, at first glance, you know, argued by some more conservative doctors to be inoperable became operable and people are still alive. So I work with a particular oncologist and I want you to go see that person and have this discussion with them. So I did.
And I'm on the edge. I mean, I know the outcome, but I'm sure people are on the edge of the seat.
So I did. And I have a very vivid memory of a conversation that I had with him where he painted a like just such a visceral picture for me that I kept in my head really ever since. Mm. And it described, you know, this just sliver of hope represented by just like a kind of a tiny shard of light through a very dark window. Mm. And it was just this window of opportunity that we needed to chase. And that everything about my treatment, my life, my approach, my mental game, my physical game, everything needed to be thrown at that opportunity if I was going to make it mine. And he had no promise that it would be mine. Mm-hmm. If there was ever a way to make it happen, that was going to be it and that's what we needed to do. And I needed to make the decision as to whether we were up for that or not. And I again had arrived in his clinic in his room with like my whole posse of people. And I remember just sitting there looking at them all and they're all looking at me and I'm like, I don't really think we need to discuss this after. I think we're on board with this guy. But yeah, okay, yeah, no, we'll think about that. Thank you very much. And we got back in the car and drove away and we were like, yeah, this is our guy. The second opinion was definitely the way to go.
I'm excited to talk to the guy because I want to know if he operates on these death committees too. I'm really keen to know.
What's he saying on those death committees?
Okay. And so then obviously you went with the guy.
Went with the guy, yeah.
I feel like it's been a roller coaster since, and I want some of those peaks and troughs.
Okay. Well, I think the first peak was we sort of said, let's do 12 rounds of chemo and see what we can make happen. You know, like the chemo was going to be the thing that made the liver operable. Mm-hmm. And we just were putting everything into that. We did 6 rounds and then did some scans. And at the 6th point, we did the scans and realized that the treatment was working.
So over what time frame is that?
I was being treated fortnightly, so you do the math. So.
6 times 2.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm no expert, but I probably handled that one. Okay. And that when you say the treatment was working.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It meant that the tumours, the lesions, the growths that we could see in the liver were turning off, essentially. We're dying a happy, slow, fast, I don't know, some kind of really cathartic for me death in my liver. It was all kind of turning off. And so and kind of all the tumours, the bowel kind of tumour was less, they call it avid on the scan. So it kind of, depending on the different type of scan you have, things kind of light up on a scan. And and then in the scan that I was having, it was much less lit. And therefore less active and therefore responding to treatment. And some of them had sort of completely turned off and it was a pretty big deal at that point. Calls for much champagne.
Yeah.
Pretty sure you were there.
I recall.
Yeah.
Many, many tears of joy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because that like it just changed the trajectory completely because up until that point, like all we had to hang on to was like maybe 18 months, maybe 2 years. That's all you had. With just me going, no, I'll be fighting cancer. That's not the way that we'll be going. So this was an amazing outcome. And then we got to the 12. So we scheduled surgery. We got to 12 rounds, 24 weeks.
So you knew at that point that it was operable?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, because you know you have to keep having the conversations and walk the line with the surgeons and make sure that everyone's on board. And but we kind of knew that that's what we were tracking towards. So I had my surgery on Halloween, 31st of October, and I just again have really there's just some really vivid, visceral kind of moments for me because like in the preparation for that surgery I was like, wow, I'm gonna have to be cut open, my whole body is going to be like pulling out all my organs onto the operating table, and everyone's kind of making fun of that and doing that for fun in Halloween, and I'm actually going to be in there with my guts all over the table for real. Awesome, can't wait.
I have distinct memories that I won't go into now about this journey, but I remember the phone call that was that discovery.
Yeah.
As strongly as I remember the phone call that was the phone call to tell me that you've got cancer, and it was a high.
Yeah. I don't think there's many moments in my life that kind of equate to that moment, really. Just in terms of like, you know, you would say, oh, as a human experience, yes, of course, like the birth of your child or, but it's so different because it's like this is actually your life that has been taken from you and you kind of just feel like maybe it's just being handed back by some force that's so completely out of your control, and all you've been trying to do is kind of, you know, wedge it out of the grasp of someone else back into your own hands. And so, yeah, it was a moment. Then we had to, you know, fight through a few more. Since then.
Oh, go on.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get down into the breakdowns of how many surgeries.
Individuals, and, yeah, sure.
You know, because I've had a lot. but you know, the starting point was this surgery and we did the bowel resection at the same time. So many people with bowel cancers will have experienced having to have stoma bags and reversal of stoma bags, and then we have to kind of redirect the bowel for periods of time. I didn't need to do anything like that. So I literally, you know, went to sleep with cancer, woke up with no cancer, and everything else was just kind of a period of recovery for me. And then there's a little bit of, okay, we'll do some more chemo and then we'll stop and then we'll wait and then we'll watch and then we'll see and then we'll do more, you know. And eventually we kind of had a feeling maybe there was something in my lung and then it presented itself. So then we had to operate on that and then just basically started a long, slow process of just carving up Nicole's lungs. So I've had 2 lobectomies and lots of little wedge resections out of my lungs. I've had a lot of lung surgery. And then I don't know, ... etc. A lot more treatments, and now we're here. That's kind of the way I'll summarize it at that point.
Okay, so ... etc. Now we're here.
Yeah.
I don't have a question for that. I hadn't prepared myself for skipping over 4 years of the 5 year
sorry.
Experience.
Sorry. But, you know, like it kind of is at a certain point, I think being a stage four patient translates into this zone of just being a fighter. And this is an interesting kind of conversation for me, right, because lots of people who are stage four patients get very upset with the characterization of a cancer fight as a fight, right? Mm. That's my language. I'm using that to talk about my own situation and my own journey. Cancer journey, any inverted commas. but I consider this to be a fight because it just – it takes all of me all the time. It is a full-time job. And
one that you didn't choose, right?
Like, it's one that I didn't choose, and it's one that I have to be so invested in, and not only me, but all of my support network, everyone around me, you know, my husband, my son, my immediate family, you know, my mum and dad, my bros, everyone must always prioritize Nicole and her treatment and her life before they prioritize their own. And I know they do, and I know you all do. And so I think that, you know, at a certain point, after you kind of realize what you've achieved, realize you've made it an operable scenario, but realize you're not immediately going to achieve a cure, and maybe you'll never achieve a cure, then it becomes a full-time fight. And I think that that's where I insert ... etc. because it is, you know, it is a fight, and it is a full-time fight, and it's one that I intend to continue to pursue. And so at a certain point, I think I kind of emotionally step away from characterizing, oh, then we did this thing, and then we did this test, and then we did this operation, and then we started this treatment, and then we wanted this to happen, but actually this happened. So then we went down this path, because it just, I mean, one, it's just so mentally and emotionally exhausting.
Sure.
And physically exhausting. Mm. And it's not, I don't think it's helpful for me anymore to think about it that way, you know, to kind of step through each stage of every single thing that's happened and why, because I just have to keep going, you know, and I think also because I've done so much of it, part of it is trauma, you know, part of it is it's very traumatizing to have to go through it all. And I don't mean that in a, I don't want to talk about it way, but more just it's hard to talk about it way. But I think also because I've had so many treatments that impact my mind, my memory, my, I define, you know, without a prompt sheet of exactly what, you know, when I started that chemo and what date I wrapped up, and, you know, was that before or after the fifth lung surgery, or was that before or after the first or the second rib that we removed, you know, or the third or the fourth mistake that was made, you know, at a certain point you just kind of have to go, yeah, it was in there.
I'm gonna call you out on this. Okay. I'm going to do it because okay. I've heard you say this a lot.
Yeah.
I don't remember what I had for dinner last night, right? Like that's where I'm at. And that's not because of any sort of traumatic or otherwise experience or medically induced sort of memory loss type situation.
Yeah.
That's just because I'm a moron. And you're sitting here, and I think everyone would agree, speaking very eloquently about a really sort of emotionally exhausting, taxing circumstance.
Yeah.
And there's no indication that you're in any way struggling with that, right? Like you're killing it, man.
Thanks.
And I think we need to stop with this.
Sorry.
Almost self-deprecation.
I'm sorry.
We're done with that. Okay. I've had enough of it.
All right. It's on the record.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anyway, carry on. Where were you up to?
And what happened next? And what date was that? Yeah, I think that some of the important things to kind of call out is that there have been some pretty significant mistakes that have been made in my care. And
okay, I want names and I want dates.
And some of that is interesting, and we can delve into a lot of this, I guess, when you start to talk to a system expert on the way that things go wrong. But I think that, you know, I, again, kind of would always walk a line of like, well, you know, my case is a really complex case. And when you treat complex cancers, you know, there's a consent process that happens, and there's a recognition that that's going to be, you know, this is going to be tough work, and it comes with complexity. And I hope that everyone's, you know, bringing their A game on that day. But there are things that are just also out of our control. There's some things that perhaps were an underperformance, like when we took the wrong rib out, which was just in the moment a little bit disappointing to me, because it also meant mostly that we missed the cancer and left the cancer in my body during that time. And you just don't know what that meant, right, for my...
Took the wrong rib out.
They took the wrong rib out, yeah. You know, there's a bit of a hole in my chest now.
So presumably the rib had, I mean, I know the answer to this, but the rib had cancer and that's why we were taking the rib out.
Yeah.
So then they took out a rib that didn't have cancer.
Yeah.
I'm assuming then tested the rib and went, hey, no cancer.
Yeah. You make that assumption and I think it's because you know that you were there. But yeah, no, we tested it and hey, no cancer, which means, okay, great, we've responded to treatment. So yeah. Every time you test something and there's no actual disease and you think, oh, wow, now we've had a treatment response.
Changes
so
not your outlook, right?
Yeah, you're like, you know, it's not just that like, oh, wow, we've made a mistake, but actually we're celebrating a response that we've never actually had as well. So, you know, these are, but again, I don't like, I'm not here to kind of go, oh, well, this was a mistake and I point fingers at the, like, it's a really complex thing. Mm-hmm. And my medical team, have been superstars and you know, and I think that overwhelmingly for me, I think I look at my experience and the commitment and the collaboration to work with me as an equal in my care, which I think and I assumed was something that I would have as an Australian in our system. And I realized upon living my journey and sharing my journey with others that no, that's not the case at all. And generally people were just like pushed like sausages through this system and sometimes they get a good outcome and sometimes they get an absolutely horrendous one. And we've already heard some of those experiences and stories on this podcast. So I think for me, I am so acutely aware of how lucky I am just to have the ear of my medical team, to have the respect of my medical team, to be invited along, to be seen as a PR, and that's my baseline expectation, but for them, they really see me as the point, you know, and to sort of be thought of that way has obviously made a massive difference to me. And so, you know, I can tolerate taking the wrong rib out if we all kind of shake that off, say our sorries and move on. Do you know what I mean? I just, it's more important to me that we kind of recognize the improvement opportunities. I am a change and improvement professional after all.
Rewind the tape.
It's going to pull me up on a few things now.
You say I can tolerate taking the wrong rib out and moving along. And I'm like, if I get in an Uber to take me home and it takes me to Sydney, I've got some problems, right? That's not what I asked for. And, I mean, it hasn't done irreversible damage to my body, but I'm not okay with it.
I know.
Your mindset is admirable.
Thank you. Yeah. I admire it myself.
I'm amazing. I don't know if I've got to catch this. Okay. Now, I'm conscious of time.
As we always are because on this podcast.
We have an expert to talk to.
We do.
So I'm going to ask you the magic three questions.
Yes.
Although I need you to word it because I've never asked the question.
Nicole.
Yep.
Can you tell me, thinking about your time in the health system, can you share with me something that you think is broken, something that's working, and something that the entire system needs to hear right now?
Excited for your answer.
Thank you, Nicole, for that great question. look, you and I were joking about this, Sean, earlier, right? Like what on earth can I possibly say is working right now in the system?
Yeah.
And the thing that I actually came up with was that I think what's working at the moment are the rogue agents in the system. And what I mean by that is that I think that we've established that there are certain power dynamics, certain ways of working, certain ego factors, certain policies and approaches that sort of dictate the way things should be in medicine. And that needs to change. And what is working in medicine are those certain rogue agents who say, well, I'm not having any of that. And that's not the way I'll be operating today. That's not the way I'll be treating my patients today. That's not the approach that I'll be taking today. And when that happens and when people make a decision actually really in the best interests of their patient,
mm-hmm.
But also in the best interests of medicine, in the best interest of the pursuit of what they set out to do in the first place. I think when those people, you know, and I call it going rogue, and it shouldn't be going rogue. It should be going back to first principles in the whole intent of what we're trying to achieve here. But in our system, it's going rogue. And so for me, what's working is the fact that those people exist, and the people who are choosing to do that are doing it and doing it well, and great, fantastic examples of care are coming through. But to be honest, I haven't seen very many great examples of care that come through when people follow the protocol. And I'm just telling it like it is.
Yeah, no, you are.
And I'm a management consultant. I know protocols. I've written many in my time. And in the area of medicine, there's not very many outstanding results and really great outcomes for patients that occur when people follow the protocol. So what's working for me is when people go rogue.
And obviously not to the extent that they take out the wrong rib.
No,
obviously,
that's a bit too rogue.
There's a line. That's all I'm trying to say. Okay. Well, that's working. What's broken?
I think what's broken is this system that calls itself patient-centric, which is just an absolute load of rubbish. Mm. And it's broken because we continue to say it, and we're actually doing ourselves, each other, the system, patients, in today, in future, in past, a lot of harm and damage every time we say our system is patient-centric, because it's not.
Mm.
You know, I could go outside today and say that Australia is really climate focused, and we have a beautiful climate, and we're so lucky that we live in this beautiful Australian climate. But that would be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a man swimming across a football field this week, so I think, well, there might be some problems.
Completely, yeah. Right? It's just wrong. And so, you know, and we can say it. We feel a lot better about life. We can all sit around and say, yeah, but aren't we so, you know, and politically it's probably, you know, a more palatable thing for everyone to be saying and hearing. It's still wrong, okay? So I think that, you know, we need to acknowledge that we live in a system that is system-centric, and that patients need to be system-centric in order to survive. You know, and to call ourselves a patient-centered healthcare system is just frankly incorrect.
Yeah.
It's and the articulation of that, the fact that we say that so often, it's so broken. It's so broken that it's okay for us to go through, you know, life, whether we work as a member of parliament, whether we work in a hospital, whether we work in a healthcare, a private healthcare provider, whether we work in a path lab, you know, if we're calling ourselves patient-centered, then we better be delivering pretty outstanding patient-first care. And I just don't think that the way that the system is established at the moment allows us to do it, unless we're going a little bit rogue and we're doing things a little bit differently and we're thinking exclusively for the patient first. And I just don't think there's many opportunities to do that at the moment.
Something the whole system needs to hear.
I feel I'm being very controversial today.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you've brought your controversial pants. It's good.
My controversial pants.
As my girlfriend, hey, Carly, hi. I'm glad you're listening. As she would say, rowdy trousers.
Oh, yeah, my rowdy trousers. Look, this point flows from my last point, I think, what every single person in the system needs to hear right now. And I don't want to be – this is not a negative statement. I'm not trying to be overtly negative. You know, like I'm a change professional. I'm a like, let's everyone come together and work together and do better to improve.
I think you're getting that across.
So what I want everyone else in the system, including myself, to hear right now is that Australia does not have the best healthcare system.
Okay, so you did just go full-blown controversial. You decided
Oh, yep. Really? Yeah, I just went for it.
Yeah, okay, let's go.
Because we hear this, again, all the time. We're so fortunate and lucky that we have the best healthcare system, and we don't. And again, if we keep saying we do, then it's permissible for us to live in mediocrity and to just accept the standard of care that is being offered to patients. You know, like we know that we can do better. We know that we have drugs that are available now to treat conditions way, like I'm talking way beyond cancer, to help Australians live better lives, longer lives. Today, we have those opportunities today, and they're not being delivered to patients. We're not connecting patients to the standard of care that they deserve. We're not treating patients as equals in their care. We talk of this idea about partnership in care. We don't even have patients who are participants in their care. And I think until we actually start to do that, we can't sit back and be really proud and have a little bit of a head wobble and say we're so lucky that we have this, you know, amazing Australian system, because we don't. We just don't, you know, but we could. And it's something to aspire to. But again, until we own a problem, there is nothing to improve. Okay, until we sort of say this thing is broken, and if it's not really articulated in a broken way, well, let's break it. Let's really call out the bits that are broken. Mm. There's nothing to fix, so we gotta do that now.
Look,
yeah,
I feel like we could talk to somebody.
Could we talk to someone who we could kind of pin the blame on?
Would have
preferably
to be
a doctor,
some sort of oncological specialist.
Yeah, I think some kind of medical specialist, particularly in the area of cancer, that would be helpful. I think if we could just pin the blame on someone, so we feel better about things.
So we feel better about ourselves.
Yeah.
Yes.
Any ideas?
We've done things a bit differently. Normally, when we record, we do like the interview with the patient, and then the interview with the expert, and then once we've got those two things, we sit together and we record like the little intro bit,
yeah,
and then the little cut the two things together.
You're giving away all of our secrets, but yeah,
yeah, okay. That's normally how we do things.
That's yeah.
And today we did things a little differently.
We did
where we recorded this discussion with our expert sitting in the room.
Oh, he is in the room.
He's just to your right. If you just cast
Holy
your gaze,
moly.
We have a doctor at the house.
We do. We have Dr. Prasad Khouri, medical oncologist. Welcome to the Inpatient Podcast.
Thank you.
Not only oncologist, your oncologist.
My oncologist.
The dude.
He is the dude.
He's the guy.
He's the guy.
I don't know if you heard the story, but he's the guy from the story.
He was in the story. He was. Any comments on the story? I mean, it's one you know. How was I in telling it? Any blatant omissions?
Well, first of all, I need to say this, and that is that I'm most privileged to be your doctor, your oncologist.
Thank you.
Okay. This level of engagement, this level of knowledge and participation and partnership, really, it's only possible because you do what you do. That brings the best out of me as well. So it really is a privilege.
Oh, I'm going to cry. Thank you.
I'm sitting in a room with the dream team.
not the intended effect, but I really mean that.
That's really, thank you.
So, no, I think you got the initial, all the story and
before
the backstory.
She did skip over 75% of it. That's fine.
Yeah, many, many dots there, many, many derailments that we had to pull back from.
Yes.
And that happened. But like you said, when we're doing hard things, really hard things, trying to do the impossible, things will go wrong. And then you got to pull back from that and figure out what's the next best thing, what's the next path forward. And that's what we've done and all along.
Sorry, let me ask. You talked already about Nicole's level of engagement in this process. To what extent does that have an effect on her outcome?
I think we might need to go back onto what the system is to address that, because simple as that may sound, it is a complex question. So my view of this network, what we call our healthcare system, is it's evolved into what we have now, and I see that as a, you know, that mesh that you use when you're concreting, metal mesh, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have multiple layers of those meshes. Let's assume the first layer is the first mesh is the doctor mesh. Okay, so you've got specialists, general practitioners, that's one layer. And then there's another layer, that's the nurses, all the supporting staff in the ward. Then you've got another mesh of allied health people, Then you have a mesh of radiologists, the diagnostic person, the person who does the blood test, person who does the run the lab. So, and then we have the admin layer. That's a whole massive meshwork of there. So the system, in my view, is composed of multiple meshes, meshworks put together. And obviously, each of those points are made in a mesh. It's made by an individual. Characters. And so the system then, you patients go through this system and everyone claims the patient is going to be controversial here. Sorry.
I like that here.
Claims that we are patient-centric, but as Nicole pointed out, the system exists to keep the system going.
Mm.
And what it does is treat patients, put the patients through. So I can't say the system is patient-centric. It's that the patient needs to know the system in order to get your outcome. Just yesterday, one of my friends called. Mum's in a nursing home. Sorry, I'm digressing a little bit.
No, please do.
With gangrenous toes. And she's been referred to a dermatologist to treat her this urticaria, but she can't walk because her toes have gone gangrenous and she's newly diagnosed diabetic, newly. And he doesn't know how do I get the treatment she needs? Because what, does she die now? And so the points of contact that he's got in that system is not helping him to get the care that his mum needs.
Mm.
And this happens all the time. So system, if the patient needs to know how the system works to get the outcome that you want. So coming back to your question, Nicole, I think from the word go, understood that really well. And as a result, she sought a second opinion. She realized that, hey, if you guys are all in the same team and saying the same things, of course you're all going to say the same team, same thing. Mm. And so to understand that is a big thing. And how does that make it work for me? When you have the engagement and understanding and health literacy from the patient, then it straight away becomes a partnership. If you are patient-centric, if you're not, then you're a pain.
Yeah.
But if you are patient-centric, then this is your partnership, right? Then we are on the same wavelength. Mm. We both want the best thing for you, best outcome for you, and let's work this out together. So that's what makes a difference. Otherwise, I'm dragging someone along. This is what's good for you. Mm. Let's try this. And believe me, this is better than that. You know,
is that the reality? Do you get
that? That's the reality, again, because health literacy is very low.
Mm.
And that's a function of the system holds the knowledge. Mm.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't know what your hemoglobin is because how do you find that out? You've got to call your GP and can you give me...
I mean, it's worse than that, Prasad. I don't know what hemoglobin is. That's
good point. You should have gone to school.
Probably should have, yeah. And then I would be a better patient. Yeah. Nicole told me 13.4% was the... at her initial diagnosis, that was the likely or the number of people with her diagnosis that would make it to the 5-year mark.
Percentage chance, yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get across very eloquently.
Mm-hmm. We just established she didn't go to school. So,
so I've got many questions about how we come up with that and where we're collecting data on that. But two, how that might impact the treatment that you would give a patient?
Yeah, I just keep going back to this mesh network, mm-hmm. right? So the network exists and it does, everyone does their job. And at least I think I can speak on behalf of nurses as well as doctors. We who go into this caring professions, we go with the right intent, all of us.
Yeah.
99.9, I'm sure we do. And we go with the patient-centric view. That's our worldview when we enter med school or nursing school, 100%. And then you do your time in med school, you learn the basics, you start working with patients in the wards gradually, and then you do your intern. So in med school, in the last 2 or 3 years you spend in the wards. Then something changes because you're now in the system. You're not in this abstract university trying to do the best for your patient. We all, happens to all the doctors because we all have to go through this system, and I'm sure that's the same case for nursing. Once you enter the system, particularly when you start working as an intern, for example, you're everything to everyone else but a doctor to your patient, unfortunately, happens. So in my view, again, could be quite controversial, but you're an intern, you're the note taker in the ward round to your consultant. You're the path slip and radiology request writer to your registrar. You're the IV cannulation expert and drug chart writer to your nurses. And so that becomes your world. And it actually starts from med school, last couple of med school years. You see this panning out, mm-hmm. and to survive this system, this is what you've got to do. So you learn that and you enact it as an intern. And then, you know, there's a hierarchy, and you go through the hierarchy, and you, second year, you divest some of your tasks to the new intern, but you inherit other stuff. Now, you're the discharge summary writer to the admin.
Mm-hmm.
And there are key performance indicators that the administration network, meshwork, has dished out that everyone should do. So you get looked at from those performance indicators. But at no point does anyone pull you aside or have a tutorial about, hey, hang on, we've done all that, but let's go back to the basics. Why are we here?
Yeah.
We're here for the patient. That does not happen. And it's expected that that will be your priority because you turned up to be a doctor.
You're a doctor.
And so that's something you do in your spare time.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, hang on, you've got some spare time? No, I'll give you another KPI. So unfortunately, we go through this system to become a specialist or a GP. You spend 3, 4, 5, you know, in my case, I sort of digressed a bit and it was like 10 years, but you come out, unless you have a really strong core, I don't know, purpose in you, it's so easy to become part of the system.
Mm.
You sustain the system now. Mm. You become part of the integrated system. So, and multidisciplinary teams come out of that. So you're a member of this team because you different layers of the system come together.
This is the death committee, is that what this is?
The death committee.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Knights of the round table.
It can be, but it can be different depending on the network. So you might have a net. So the outcome, I think, is determined for any individual who enters this network or meshwork of the system is determined by how that system's holes are oriented, right?
Mm-hmm.
And really what saves the day is the individuals in different layers of that system. You could have one doctor missing a tumor on a CT, but if the surgeon looks at it carefully or the oncologist looks at the scan, you pick it up. So so there are other players who will save the day, right? And outcomes are poor when everyone's doing their own thing to save, support the system, in my belief. But if you've got enough players you might call them rogue players, but
rogue
acting beyond their KPI requirements.
Yeah.
They're the ones who actually bring out good outcomes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you say 13% 5-year survival for colorectal cancer, that's a very basic sort of lowest common denominator we should aim for, right? That's like what's the least possible scenario we could do, but that's what's quoted, you know, 8 to 13% 5-year survival.
Yeah.
But that's in a system that's just functioning, going along, humming along. We look after our system nicely, but and then that's where the protocols come from.
Yeah.
Because systems like that need a protocol, right? And it, so it's all protocolized, and they aim for the 13%. And if we achieve 13%, we're doing well.
And this is something that I've spoken about quite a lot, is that when we set low bars for ourselves and then we replicate that statistic, well, then we're pretty happy.
We're happy with it. There's not, no need to change. Unfortunately, in my view, that's what's happened in cancer treating landscape. And what that means is we are congratulating ourselves being great, meaning a very low bar.
In any case, I mean, let's say there's 100 people with Nicole's diagnosis. 13 and a half of them are going to make it to 5 years. We were talking today, like, your chance of winning the Powerball lottery is, well, 1 in 150 million. And a lot of people buy tickets. 13 in 100 is bad.
Yeah.
It could be better, I'm understanding, but still seems to me like you're going to have a swing at the pitch, right? Like,
yeah.
How it's my understanding is that the diagnosis that Nicole was given early and the subsequent treatment plan that Nicole was given early was entirely palliative. Like, okay, well, you've got your 18 months to 2 years, so we'll just do what we can to make you comfortable for that period of time.
Yeah, if you accept that 13%, well, that's, you know, you would sit very comfortable with that because, you know, you got, I mean, can I say that when you were diagnosed, you had a very high volume of disease in the liver, both sides of the liver.
Yeah.
And you did have lung lesions that we were aware of as well at the time. And so looking at it from a statistical point of view, yes, that's going to be in that 87.5 category. So why? So one system looked at you or a network and said, why put you through a harsher treatment if we accept that that's your outcome, because we project that's what it's going to be because that's the volume of cancer you've got. But, you know, I'm in a different network and I'm in a different mesh system, so to speak. And we actually create, that's something that people don't know, that in public hospital system, you're forced to be in that meshwork. And that's one of the freedoms that I have being a private oncologist, is that I create my own meshwork. So I've got the people that I need that who have the same mindset, and we get together and we create our system. So when we have an MDM, that MDM comes from a different view.
It's a fair point. Still, my first opinion was a private team.
Yes, yes, that's an interesting point.
And so
yes.
I think that, you know, the difference that I'm kind of picking up on here is what Sean's kind of alluding to, is it surely if you've got, you know, a 13%, let's just call it that, 13% opportunity at driving change, you know, making a difference to the outcome, you would shoot for that. Whereas what Team A in this instance were thinking was that, well, no, there's only that percent chance that there's only the other side. You know, there's only the 80. What are we?
Yeah. The way I see it is this, right? You've got 100 people on a start line to a running race. It's a 100-meter race. And there's a bunch of lions and they're chasing you. And at the start line, they say to you, hey, guys, you got to run the 100. You don't have a choice as to whether or not you participate. You're participating now.
Yeah.
87 of you will die. 13 of you will survive. Off you go.
Yeah.
I'm running.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way I'm just going to stand and wait for the lion.
Yeah.
Like, there's 13's a big enough number to make me run.
And if you're 32 and you've got a 8-month-year-old at home, you're going to run. And you need someone to help you in that run.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's right.
So I look at Nicole. I remember that first consultation. And he's a very intelligent, engaged person who's 32, who's got everything to live for. If we go with the standard assumption that 87% chance no, but well, let's look at the other, flip it around, we'll give it every chance we can.
Exactly. And what opportunities sit in that 13%?
Will that open up?
Yeah.
That's right. Here we already have a surgeon who has said, look, if you can get Nicole over this bar, I would be prepared. I'll think about it.
Yeah.
And I've already got that assurance by that stage.
Mm.
And but we had no illusions, like you remember. Mm. It was a very slim crack that we were aiming for, which is why Nicole had to put everything into it, exercise hard and get yourself motivated and run the race. And I think it brings me to this other point that we know the 13% is not the benchmark because we've done an audit of our own network, and you can reach 3-4 times that figure, 5-year survival. You can.
3 or 4 times 13%.
13%, which is possible, which is the craziest thing, right?
That seems like I say it a lot. I'm no expert, especially with numbers, but that seems to be like a bar that we should be aiming for.
Statistically significant, I would have thought.
Yeah, it feels like it.
If you had 100 Nicole starting this race, it'll be 50% finishing that race.
Mm.
Because stage 4 colorectal cancer, there's many variations of colorectal cancer depending on the mutation status and what biomarkers that have, what particular types of drugs the cancer will be sensitive to, the distribution of cancer, the volume of cancer, all those things are variables.
Right.
I think there's a distinction between potentially that long-term survival achievable, and I don't mean that at 5-year mark you'll be cured of the cancer, but you will be here in a meaningful, functional person in the community versus not being here. In stage 4 colorectal cancer, I think it's time that we make that distinction that what's possible, even to a point like maybe dividing into stage 4A, potentially long-term remission achievable in some sort of abbreviation versus no. Mm. Because things have moved so far in colorectal cancer, drugs-wise, what's available to me as an oncologist, what the surgeons are prepared to do. Not every surgeon, but select networks will have those players. Like it happened in your case, where you look at a case and say, yeah, it's not doable now, but there's an opening.
Yeah.
Commitment
to intent.
With intent, it comes exactly. I think it comes down to intent.
Yeah.
There are some cancers where you can't make that distinction, like, for example, pancreatic cancer. We just don't have enough drug options. We just don't have enough surgical options to deal with that cancer.
Mm.
But I think, 10 years' time, that would have moved, and we'll be looking at pancreas cancer from this is potentially operable, this is clearly not operable and not curable, and this is, subcategorize them. But that happens with technology and using up-to-date what's available.
Mm.
We are there with colorectal cancer. We were there 5 years ago, even before that, but the systems haven't caught up with it.
And I think that this is the thing that just infuriates me, because I can see, I know that my health literacy made a difference. I know that for lack of a better, holistic descriptive word, privilege has made a difference. I know that my access to financial avenues has made a difference to my outcomes. And so, what I find so extraordinarily unfair in our system, and why I really push back about us talking this talk about how it's so great is that if you don't have access to those things, if you aren't health literate, if you don't have, you know, money to pay for different drugs, or you don't even have money to pay for hospital car parking, you know, you don't get the access to the same outcomes, to even the same opportunity for the same outcomes. And it might be that you stumble across a network of people within the private system who might be able to, or sorry, the public system, who might be able to offer you just as great an ultimate outcome, but you don't have the wherewithal or the support to recognize that opportunity or to seize that opportunity. And I think that this is the thing that makes me so frustrated for patients in our system, is that there is such a lack of system-wide acknowledgement of the number of hurdles that stand between a patient and a positive outcome in the face of, and let's just talk metastatic colorectal cancer for a second. Let's just keep our conversation to that. You know, I think our system is so happy to say it's just a really bad cancer and it's a really sad story, and that's why the outcome will be bad. And that's not right. That's not enough. That doesn't even start to touch the sides of the argument of what will actually influence the outcome for each individual patient. And as you say, it's so much of it is to do with the other individuals who are playing a role in their care. And until those individuals recognize the role that they play and own that role and own the individual influence that they can have on directing the outcome, I don't think we'll see a change. You know, I think in another 5 years, we'll still be talking about, you know, nudging 13% to 14% and how we should all be really happy about that.
Yeah, entirely agree. I actually had a GP meeting, Nicole knows about it, last week, purely on the topic of young onset colorectal cancer. Oh. Yeah.
And whose idea was that?
I think your idea. Yeah, just clarifying. Which, like, overnight I had to change my slides and in the morning.
Sorry. It's all about being patient-centric. But,
yeah. It was very relevant, and GPs were, like, this group of doctors. Mm. They were mortified that this is happening.
Yep.
They had an inkling that, yes, there's this trend, but how significant it is. And they, you know, they really... They're caught in this place where the meshwork had instilled in them that they need to be health economists. So they're caught between, you know, do I scope everyone that, or refer everyone who's got these symptoms to a gastroenterological scope? What would the cost be to the system, and can we do that to everyone? And a whole raft of questions. But what I tried to say is that let's go back to the patient, and you know, if you thought about this could be bowel cancer in a young person, until you rule that out, it is bowel cancer in a young patient. And simply because the implications of it being missed is so huge. Often we know that young onset bowel cancer is diagnosed late, often at a later stage, and it's harder to treat. And health economics-wise, if someone actually sat down and did these maths, doing colonoscopes on every suspected young onset colorectal cancer would be saving the system so much more money than putting them through 5 years of treatment that you alone had to go through. But they haven't done that. So, you know, the doctors want to do the right thing. But I keep coming back to this system that has trained us to be everything but the patient-centric doctor that we listed to be.
Yes.
Put our name up to be.
And then that's a system that then is ticking along going, oh, we're doing well, we're doing good things. We just need to incrementally make some slight adjustments to make sure we continue to do great things.
Yeah.
Which, you know, goes back to the point that I started with, to say if it's not broken, it will never be fixed. And until we acknowledge it being broken,
Yeah.
It will never be fixed.
It will never be fixed because there's not no need.
Exactly.
We're not measuring exactly. anything wrong.
And, this is, you know, the work that I have been doing with Bowel Cancer Australia has really unearthed this, you know, issue that we don't actually have any opportunity to screen for young onset colorectal cancer.
Yeah.
And the only presentation that we have of young onset colorectal cancer is when someone rocks up maybe with a symptom
yep.
that then is passed off as, oh, well, it's probably a gluten intolerance or maybe it's IBS or, you know, you're feeling a little bit anxious, you just need to calm down a little bit. And I think, you know, ultimately, even if all of those scenarios had been handled and GPs were more aware and did take more did feel more empowered.
Empowered. I think that's where it comes from, yes.
That empowerment to use a scope when a scope, you know, probably should be used.
GPs are prepared. They need to be empowered. Yeah. That's where the problem lies in this system. The system has taken that power away from the individual.
Mm.
So like you say, who they're seen as rogue.
Yeah.
But what they're doing is they're doing what they're, you know, they put their name up to be,
a
doctor and a nurse
yeah.
with the patient-centered approach.
Looking to solve an individual problem for an individual patient. And I think that that is, I don't know, I feel like we've heard that a couple of times, right? We've heard that from Adam, Susanna, you know, I talk about my rogue agents. Prasad talks about his mesh and the people within that who are able to function, you know, free from the grip of what the system sort of dictates they should or could be doing. And I think that that needs to be an overwhelming theme, is that the power of an individual decision maker on the outcome.
I think we had this discussion earlier in the week about health literacy, how important it is, and how much that health literacy makes my job easier.
Yeah.
And the system, we hold that knowledge, and unless we are prepared to open the gates and let the patients have the knowledge about their own health.
Yeah.
The health literacy is not going to happen. People can't go and Google every bit about themselves and email the GP or doctors, hey, can I have this report, that report? They don't even know how to interpret it. Yeah. So as much as we really want health literacy, it's held in the system. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my job is I'm like a teacher. I'm actually educating the person I come across. Or try to as to where they're at and what things are. I very often, like all the time, I look at the scans with my patient.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very easy way to explain what's going on in your body.
Yep.
I treat cancer, this cancer in the scan.
Yep.
And we start from there.
Mm.
And so unless you invest in that health literacy of your patient, and then people have something to hang on to and build on.
So
I believe that health literacy starts in the system, but the system often doesn't have the time to do that. Particularly in a busy clinic, you just don't have time to look at scans with patients.
Yeah.
Do you know the other thing that I don't think is clear enough, because it's not clear enough in my head, is the second opinion stuff. Particularly in your case.
Yeah.
So specific to you.
Mm-hmm.
Your second opinion got you on a train of different treatment that you would not have had if you had stuck with the first team.
Yeah.
Which has obviously had a monstrous impact on your overall outcome.
Yeah.
So the importance of second opinions, I think, needs to be.
Yeah. And I think that it's important for people to feel, for patients to feel empowered. And we've spoken about empowerment for medical professionals, but I think that it's so critical that patients in any scenario feel empowered to get a second opinion. And, you know, you can do that privately when you've got the opportunity to pay for private fees. But equally, you know, if you go to a public hospital and try to see someone there or get an opinion there that doesn't sit well with you, you're well within your rights to go to a different public hospital. The problem is waiting times, and the problem is, you know, that's not
it's just not practically
possible.
The only avenue open to you is turn up to an emergency department of a different system.
And hope for the best.
Is that really the...
Well, you can ask for your GP to refer you to a different hospital, but then there's waiting times just to get seen, and in the meantime, you're not having the appropriate treatment anything that you could be having. So it's really hard in the public system. Private system is a little bit easier because things happen faster and it's more open to that proposition. Mm-hmm. It's tough.
But I think it's also that, you know, sometimes it is only one more conversation that you need to have that perhaps then kicks off a conversation between sort of medical peers. And I think that
would be ideal.
Yeah. This is like, I think something to keep in mind sometimes is that you can, you know, you could get an opinion that is, you know, not necessarily a great one. You could get a second opinion that just piques the interest of a medical professional who, you know, who's a naturally curious person who wants to, you know, help a sick person.
So, and you need that empowered clinician in that seat.
Yeah, that's
who then sings, this person, let's get a second opinion for you. I'll call someone.
I'll call someone who doesn't usually bulk bill, but I'm just going to get them to see because it's a relationship I have. Even I'm going to call back to this doctor I've never heard of, doctor number one, and just say, well, have we considered this, or this is kind of outside, or this person doesn't actually have, you know, the insurance to be privately treated. But, you know, do you know what I mean? Sometimes there's just a conversation that can happen or a referral that can happen or a friendly handshake that can happen. And again, that's not the way that it should be, and that's not the protocol, and that's not what the system intended in its design. But to get the best outcome for patients and for people who are going, how do I get out of this? How do I find another avenue to potential alternative opinion on care? I think they're some of the things that people can think about.
Yeah. And some of the second opinions I see, I just educate them and people, they're fine. They go back to where they were having their treatment. That's fine. They're just more aware of what's going on now, and that's all they needed. It was just a sounding education board. Sounding board.
I'm stuck on, and I'm going to be perpetually stuck on, I think, this idea that, Nicole, if you were a public patient, then you probably didn't have time to go for a second opinion.
No.
Like, that is the most depressing thing I've taken out of today. So
why do you always take such depressing things out of our discussions?
This is a glass half full person.
Yeah, so. But I'm the guy with a mental health injury, all right? Yeah. So if I want to be depressed, I'm going to be depressed.
I'm sorry. You're well within your rights to be depressed. I acknowledge the fact that you've shared it with us. I thank you for being so open. Please continue to do so.
You're laying it on a little
thing. Okay, sorry, I don't know. I'm not a mental health professional. I've got no idea what I'm doing over here. But I think that your point is right, and I think that the fact that that if you're in that system, I mean,
can I interrupt though?
Please do.
So, in public system, I personally have, and I know other doctors have, gone with this intent, because there are some individuals in that system still feel empowered to do that. So it does happen. But the chances are probably lower, I would say. And it, again, it depends on the system, right? If you've got a group, a hospital group, where more individuals like your team were in there, they would pick up the phone and talk to the surgeon and what do you think? And if we go really hard at this, would you consider? It can happen. So I don't rule that out. It does happen. But I think the patient-centeredness can fall away because not one individual is responsible for your care.
Yes.
And that's where the problems can arise.
Yeah. And I think that that's a great point, that a lot of people wouldn't understand that, you know, that there is quite often a switch up in in, for example, the oncologist who you're seeing in the public system is going to depend on the particular clinic that's running on the particular day and who's, you know, who's available. And I know many of my friends who have been treated publicly who never saw the same oncologist twice. And then I know others who were treated publicly and did see the same oncologist every fortnight.
All the time, and
so that experience is really variable. And so much of that is to do with where you're located geographically.
Yeah,
and, you know,
what the system is, the clinic structure is.
Exactly.
Yeah, so many variables.
Not, you know, the same everywhere you go.
Yeah.
But that the influence of having different players involved is quite significant, just in terms of continuity of care and having someone as a single point of advocacy for you as a patient. And I think that that's, for me, given this is my episode, I'm going to wrap this up the way I want to. Thanks. People are getting a lot of insight, as we did into Molly when she talked to us about her freaking kind of representation at the GP all the time.
Yeah.
People are getting a lot of insight into how much of a neurotic kind of control freak I am.
We're getting to know the real
the
Nicole.
Real Nicole. Not so inspirational now.
I'm inspired to turn this off.
I think that, you know, I have been so inspired myself, right, to become a patient advocate insofar as I've seen what the system is dealing out for some individuals, for many individuals and even for me, and it's not good enough. And that has the impact of and the capacity of one person to generate change, I think is so profound. And if something that if we all individually within the health system lived by, we would have a very different system. But I think I, as it is my episode, I want to acknowledge that so much of that in me has come from my doctor, my oncologist, Prasad, because I see in you this determination to tackle the hardest problems. You know, I see in you this like almost fanatical commitment to your patient.
Mad.
And then, you know, what that does for you in terms of workload and everything else, you know, the broader impact, and it's nuts. You're a crazy man. But you know, what that does for patients and what it teaches everyone else, you know, around us in terms of what it should be teaching the system about what is actually possible and how much the efforts of one person can change things, and that if we all actually bandied together and, you know, contributed as a collective, that we could be affecting even more change. So I want to get that on the record.
Thank you.
And we are a mutual admiration society, and I think everyone knows that now. But thank you for being here. Thank you for being so, I don't know, willing to share your professional expertise, but also to put yourself out there as having a, at times, a point of view that doesn't strictly align with the broader system and perhaps some of your peers. But just thank you for doing that and continuing to do the work that you do every day.
Pleasure and privilege.
I had this whole thing mapped out in my head where I was going to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Just not anywhere near that well. So what she said. thanks, Prasad. It's very, well, I'll say thanks for coming today. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you. And it's I'm in such a privileged position. So it always is a privilege what I do. Yes, I create hard work for myself, but.
But we sit here today 5 years on from Nicole's.
Exactly. Exactly.
2 year expected lifespan.
Yep.
Very happy.
Very happy.
And I feel like we have you to thank for that. So
thank you.
Cue the music, I think, because we need to bring it up a notch. And with that, we have a wrap of this episode. I've kind of felt a bit meh about making it about me, but I also wanted to tell a portion of my story. There is a lot of ... etc. in my story, but am I just feeling like the happiest patient ever to have their oncologist, full stop, and then also to and to have their oncologist appear on their podcast. Like, just look, I think we're all lucky.
I have to disagree with you constantly. You are, I agree,
mm-hmm.
but also you create this stuff, right? Because of the person that you are and the work that you do. I don't think Prasad would disagree.
So he's taking his microphone away now.
He may not speak. I agree with you. We are immensely fortunate to have Prasad and other people in your team who are willing to do this stuff.
We are.
But it's because of you.
Thanks.
No, thank you.
Thank you for your kind words, Brother Sean.
Brother Sean. What are you talking about? Okay, Brother Sean. Namaste. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
It's actually three holes in the ground. Or one hole that you're really drawing attention to.
Well, well, well.
Well.
What is this, a well factory?
And a well. Well, well, well.